Hi, this is Tom Ward from the Majestic Group, and today our guest is Mike Smalley from Orlando, Florida. Welcome, Mike.
Hi, Tom.
I know that you're pretty well known in your marketplace down there, but there might be some people on this call that really don't know your background. And could you kind of give us a feel for how long you've been in the business and what you're doing currently and, I guess, the evolution of Mike Smalley?
Sure. Well, I spent most of my life in Orlando, and I had a brief career as a minor league baseball player. Upon the end of that career, I kind of fell into the mortgage business in the summer of 2002. Spent a little bit of time working for someone else. Started my own company in December of 2004. And in April of 2008, actually merged and joined underneath Waterstone Mortgage, which is a wholly owned subsidiary of Waterstone Bank out of Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
Wow, so you kind of came in at the beginning of probably or the middle of the heyday as far as mortgage financing was concerned and kind of evolved into the meteor shower as we've seen here over the last probably 18 months or so. What do you think, I mean, just from your opinion in your market down there, what has changed? If you're looking at mortgage financing for a consumer, give us an idea of what has changed. And maybe more importantly, what advice would you give a consumer today with regards to financing a home in 2010 and beyond?
Well, I think I could probably spend a lot less time telling you what hasn't changed because, you know, what has changed is basically everything. Going back to when I first got in the business, the way we do disclosures has changed. The way we run credit has changed. The way the appraisal process worked has changed significantly just in the last 2 months here in early 2010. The way people document their income or didn't document their income during the boom years has changed. And the way your FICO score impacts your interest rate has changed significantly. The second point of your question, you know, what advice would I give a consumer? The first advice I give them is I think now's a great time to buy, and I'd be a buyer. Home prices in Florida, and specifically in Central Florida where I am, have come down significantly from the boom, you know, 30, 40, 50%. Even more in some areas. So I think now's a great time to buy. If I was a client getting a mortgage and trying to make sure I made a sound financial decision, the two things I would do is I would have a very tight budget where I know exactly what I can afford, and afford the house and still be able to save money, which I think a lot of people plan on being able to afford it and living paycheck to paycheck, and I don't think that's a smart financial decision. And the second thing I would do is I would meet with a lender as early in the process as possible to do some pre-purchase planning, and that way when you do find the dream house that you want to buy, you have a much better picture of what the finances look like and can you afford it and is it realistically in your budget, in your price range.
Can you go into a little bit more detail? I know that your team there and I know you personally with regards to that credit score issue. Give us a for instance of what may have changed from those last 5 or 6 years over time that you've been in the business to where it is today? Because I think some people are out there making decisions or, you know, making wrong decisions based upon either wrong information or just old information. What's really changed in that FICO score?
Within the last couple of years, something has come about called a loan level price adjustment. And essentially what a loan level price adjustment is, it's an add-on or an increase to your interest rate based upon your credit score. So as your credit score decreases, your interest rate increases. And that's really appropriate for almost every type of mortgage out there, whether it's a conventional loan or an FHA loan or a VA or an USDA loan. Almost every type of mortgage has some type of credit score adjustment. So if you're looking for a property and you are doing things like they did 4 years ago when there weren't these adjustments, and when everybody qualified because there were no income and stated income verification loans, if you're shopping for a mortgage in that fashion and then you're talking to a lender after you found the house, a couple things can happen. You know, number one is you could find out that your income doesn't qualify because you took too many tax deductions or you're newly self-employed. And if you have any credit issues, then you could be looking at a much higher interest rate or even possibly not qualifying because you haven't given yourself enough time to fix any errors or things on the credit report that are inaccurate.
Mike, go back to the part where you talked about FICO scores. If you roll the clock back 4 or 5 years ago, because my experience across the country is that people are getting some wrong information, they're getting bad information out there. What was the, if you had a credit score back then, what was golden back then?
During the heyday, a golden credit score was anything above 720, and that's really still the case today. The biggest difference between 2-3 years ago and today is the person with the 680, which is an average credit score, or the guy with the 640 with a below average credit score, 2 or 3 years ago, they got the same interest rate as the person with the pristine 740 FICO. But if you're going off old information and you think that's going to be the case today, you're going to be very disappointed to know that a 640 or a 680 could be 3/4 to a full percent higher interest rate than if you had a 740.
Wow. So that makes all the sense in the world then. And I think that in a case like that where you try to be able to manipulate and maneuver those numbers a little bit, I think that you're a big proponent of meeting early. You mentioned that earlier. That's probably one of the major reasons why you want to meet with a lender first prior to going out looking at houses, because you need time to fix that, right?
Right, yeah. And there's a very high percentage of credit reports that I see either have a minor error that's relatively easy to correct, or a minor adjustment, like paying down a credit card by a couple $100, can have an impact that's great enough to put someone in the next tier up and get them a better interest rate.
It makes sense. You're just leaving money on the table, right, by doing it the old way. Obviously, you're going to make a lot of friends if you can stretch somebody's credit score up a little bit with your expertise, as well as the fact of saving them a bunch of money over time. So, excellent point. Go back to your other point where you talked about, you know, with the, I don't know what exactly what you called it. I forget it. You called it, I don't know if you called it a consultation or a planning session or something along those lines. Tell us about that. Why, you know, why do you suggest, because, I mean, we're in an internet world today, the information age. Why do you suggest for somebody to be able to meet with you? And do you do that face-to-face over the telephone? Walk us through that.
I prefer to meet with everyone face-to-face, but logistically it doesn't always work. So there are times where we meet over the web, like a web meeting software, like a GoToMeeting, or we do it over a conference call, but preferably it's face-to-face. The things that we cover, you know, you mentioned the internet. Anybody can get on the internet and get an interest rate quote. The problem is that those quotes aren't accurate because there's 25 to 30 factors that can, in fact, impact an interest rate. And if you're just searching online, those factors aren't going to be included in what you find on the internet advertising sites. When I meet with someone, there's a couple things that I talk about. One thing we talk a lot about is what makes interest rates move. Because if interest rates are between 5.5% and 6%, well, you're not going to get 5. But if you understand what makes interest rates move and what economic reports are being released in the near term, and the lender you're working with understands those things as well, you can do a pretty good job of getting closer or at the bottom end of the range that rates are in. So that's one thing we talk a lot about, is just what's our lock-in strategy going to be when you find a property. Another thing we talk about is property taxes. In Florida, you can look at two houses that are next door to each other, and they're the exact same model, square footage, size, value, and one house might have property taxes of $1,500, and one might have taxes of $3,500.
Wait, back up for a minute. You're telling me that the same price range of house could have a spread of almost double or more than double?
Yeah, it absolutely can. And the reason is because you don't know what the existing owner paid for the property or if they have filed for homestead. So where I see people get confused is they look at two properties. And so let's say you've got these two houses. And let's say one house is upgraded and looks pretty, but the taxes are higher. And let's say the other one needs a new coat of paint, but the taxes are less. Well, what they don't understand is a year and a half from when they close, their taxes are going to be the same no matter what house they purchase, because they're going to be reassessed regardless of what house they buy based upon the price that they pay for the home. So what the taxes are now is important because that's going to affect your mortgage payment for the first 12 to 18 months. But long term, we really need to be anticipating what the taxes are going to go to, because you're not going to live in the house for 12 months. You're going to live in it for 5 to 12 years potentially.
Mike, I'll tell you, from across the country, I can tell you, I've talked to a lot of people, and I can tell you this, that you just hit on three major items that save thousands of dollars over the life of that loan. You hit on credit scores, obviously getting somebody the best interest rate because this is just minor tweaks that you could get them up. You talked about monthly payment as far as taxes are concerned, and as far as locking in, I mean, if you calculated all that up, it's thousands of dollars over time, and that's just for the low, low price of coming in and meeting with you prior to way early in the process, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's an hour investment of time for
thousands
like
of dollars
said,
of return, right?
Tens of thousands of dollars, absolutely, yeah.
Wow. So when they come to you, what do you suggest? Do you suggest for them to come together? Do they need to bring anything with them? Walk us through that.
Yeah, well, if it's a couple, then I think it's always best to come together. You know, and typically you have one person who's more of the finance person and one person who's not. You know, you might have a couple where one would rather come and one wouldn't. But I think it's important for both to come because maybe they haven't had some of the discussions and conversations that I'm going to have with them, like what's your budget or what part of town do you want to be in or how many bedrooms or how big of a house. It's important for them to get on the same page for a decision as financially impactful as purchasing a property. As far as what to bring, it varies from one person to another, really based upon where their money is for their down payment and how they get paid, if they're a salaried employee or if they're self-employed. But it's typically similar things, you know, your bank statements, your retirement account statements, your paycheck stubs, W-2s, tax returns, that type of thing, just things for us to verify your income and assets.
And then when you're looking at that, you've heard all these commercials out there and you don't need to bring anything, and that's, again, old school. Do you think a customer, if they brought – obviously, you're the expert. Do you think if a customer brought that information, brought both parties, do you think they walk out of there with peace of mind, more peace of mind with you than or somebody like you than anybody else?
I think they have a lot more peace of mind. And I'll tell you who has a lot more peace of mind. When they make an offer and the party that's receiving the offer, the seller – when they receive a pre-approval letter from me that says I verified that person's income because I've reviewed their tax returns versus another pre-approval letter that says subject to verifying their income with their tax returns, you know, which offer do you think the seller is going to pay more attention to? They're going to pay attention more to the person who looks like they're prepared and qualified.
Yeah, and I think that's a great point because I think the path of least resistance for a lot of mortgage people out there today is – ooh, I'm afraid to ask somebody to bring in the following information. But if I'm a consumer today, I want to be able to know that based upon what you've seen as an expert, Mike, that you see my paycheck, you see how much money I take home, you see how much money I gross, you see what my debts are, you're going to give me a pretty good indication as far as where that's at. And I can also give you some pulse on what my lifestyle's like, right?
Absolutely. And I'll tell you one other thing I found, Tom, is that if I get your tax returns early on in the process when you're still looking for a home, it's pretty easy for you to find it. But if I'm not getting your tax returns until you've already written a contract, you're already packing boxes and putting things away and putting things in storage to clean the apartment or the other house out, and it's going to be more difficult for you to find the documents that I need because you're already uprooting your life from where everything has been stored for the past, you know, certain amount of years. So it's actually more difficult to get it if you wait till after you've found a property.
Yeah, we're just out of sound mind and body when it gets down to the nitty-gritty, right?
Yeah, and there's all kinds of moving parts at that point in time. You know, I'm asking you for your tax returns. You're scheduling home inspections and trying to set up the utilities and get your kids registered for a new school, and it leads to a lot of stress. So getting the documents gathered early just gives you peace of mind and reduces your stress level significantly.
We're here at the tail end of April of 2010. The looming tax credit, you know, there's $8,000 for the first-time home buyer, and there's $6,500 out there for the move-up home buyer. It doesn't look like there's no press out there. It does not look like that's going to be extended. Give us your pulse. Give us your feelings on post-tax credit. Give me some advice. If I'm a consumer out there kind of freaking out a little bit, thinking I missed the boat or nobody told me about it or I was tied up or I was overseas, talk to us about that.
Well, I'd say, first of all, the tax credit's been a huge success, in my opinion. And I don't think that it's caused people to buy houses, but I think it's caused some people to buy it a little bit earlier than they had planned on, which is, you know, that's fine. That's a good decision to get $8,000 to move up your time frame by 3 months. But for people who miss the tax credit, to me, earlier this year, there was the perfect storm of why you should buy now. You had low sale prices, low interest rates, you had the tax credit, and you had a ton of inventory. So it was a buyer's market. Well, so you remove the tax credit from that equation, you still have low interest rates, you still have a lot of inventory, so it's still a good buyer's market, and you still have home prices that are significantly cheaper than they were years ago and as affordable as they'll ever be in Central Florida.
Do you think anybody's concerned with, I know it's sometimes where you've got siblings involved, and a lot of the consumers that I talk to said, my brother bought a home 4 years ago, and he was making 7 or 8% a year on the house. Do you think there's a concern in the marketplace that if I'm a consumer today that I'm really, really concerned with my house is not a great investment anymore? Talk to us about that.
I honestly think that's a big concern because you have a lot of people that saw someone else purchase a property that dropped in value 30%, and maybe they lost it to foreclosure, or maybe they had to short sell it. To give you an analogy, when do you buy a stock? Do you buy a stock when the stock market's at 11 or 12,000, or is it a better investment to buy it when the stock market's at 7,000? I mean, you ask any expert investor, you know, when does Warren and Buffett buy stocks? He buys stocks when they're cheap, you know, not when they're overvalued. So people today that are worried about making the mistake that maybe their friend or family did when they bought in 2005 at the peak, well, what they're doing now is the exact opposite of that. They're buying to the bottom. So although I can relate and understand, you know, that fear, I think that if they sat back and thought through that fear, they'd realize that it's definitely not a fearful time to buy, and the likelihood of that happening to you is very, very small.
So let's just say that the house prices were going to go up very little. You know, somebody's going to compare that to, obviously, renting. Forecast it. Give us the crystal ball. You know, fast forward the tape. What's it going to look like, in your opinion?
Well, yeah, I think home prices are likely to be flat to slightly up. But even if your home doesn't appreciate in value, where prices are now, you can purchase a property for basically the same amount of money you can rent it for. And that's not even factoring in that you can deduct the mortgage interest and property taxes. You know, it doesn't even take into the tax considerations. And then another thing is, let's say you rent an apartment for 30 years and you pay $1,000 a month. At the end of 30 years, all you have is the rent you've paid. Let's say you go out and find a house for $150,000 and it cost you $1,000 a month. At the end of 30 years, you've got $150,000 in equity. So even if the home doesn't appreciate in value, you know, it's still a much better financial investment.
Well, that's showing, I mean, that's probably over 30 years. If it doesn't go up $1, that's probably really an extreme to that side. But that would give me some peace of mind to be able to. And I don't think, you know, from my perspective, I don't think people take that into consideration when you look at that. Because if you're looking at a side-by-side comparison, just like you just said, it's an awesome comparison. Looking at side-by-side, if I rent for 30 years, I'm guaranteed to have zero. And if I bought a house on a 30-year fixed rate at the end of 30 years and it didn't go up $1, I'd at least have the equity that I paid for it. Yeah, great analogy. And that's with or without a tax credit. I mean, obviously that was there, but if you could have bought before with a tax credit, you know, God bless America. But if you're still there, it's still a good investment and it's still a good deal. Now, I want to go back to something else, which is really kind of a phenomena in the marketplace. And I think that there's two things that I think you hit on that I really want to be able to bring light to. Number one, you mentioned the regionalization of your market and your taxes. I think real estate is regional, always has been, always will be. So I think that it's always important to be able to deal with somebody in the market that you are in. If you're going to do business over the internet with somebody who's got a call center in California, they're not going to be able to, and try and do it over the phone, they're not going to have any idea of what's happening in Orlando, let alone the fact of the tax consequences that you just talked about.
Yeah, that's very true. And I mean, probably once a week I talked to someone on the phone who had talked to out-of-state lender, and I spent half the conversation just correcting their mistakes, especially in Florida, because the underwriting guidelines are so much different. You know, we kind of joke when we go to our managers' meetings at our corporate office every quarter, and the underwriters tell us about new underwriting guidelines, we kind of always throw up our hands and say, well, tell us what the Florida guidelines are, because Florida is a different animal. And I guess I could throw in Arizona, California, and Nevada in that same bucket, but, you know, you've got your underwriting rules, then you've got the rules for those four states.
Did you say it's probably more of a custom world today than it was 5 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, because how people are paid affects what type of documentation you have to get. And, you know, going back to the out-of-state thing, I would never dream to attempt to do a loan out of state. There are just too many differences in how closing costs are calculated and what the underwriting guidelines are and who the appraisers are and how the loan's underwritten, who pays for what closing cost, you know, what does the seller pay, what does the buyer pay. Everything is so customized that you've really got to focus in on a geographic area if you want to be professional and do a good job for your clients and be accurate with the advice that you give.
And over those 7-plus years that you've been in the business, obviously, if you're conducting your business, what you just said here, I'm sure your referrals, because, Mike, I can tell you from a nationwide perspective what you do, and you're making this sound like it's just an everyday occurrence for you. This is not normal. In the mortgage arena nationwide, from my perspective, there still is somewhat of a, I call it inbox-to-inbox mindset rather than face-to-face, and I think that the consumer is dying to get information from people that they can trust and from people who have knowledge, local knowledge of the market. So I applaud you for it, man. I think it's something that, and I know that's harder for you, right? I mean, I know how much time and money you spend on making sure you're on top of interest rates. It's got to be almost a full-time job to stay, especially in Florida. It's got to be almost a full-time job in your marketplace to stay on top of guidelines.
If it's not a full-time job, it's close to it.
Yeah. Do you see people, I remember 5-6 years ago, again, a lot of people got into the business because it was easy money. Do you think that we've seen a demise of the part-time loan officer, the person who's just kind of trying to do this as a sideline?
I don't think there can be such a thing anymore. I mean, I think there probably are people who are attempting it, but you can't do it. It's impossible. You cannot be part-time in this industry right now because there are so many changes you have to keep up with. You know, you wouldn't know how to complete a good faith estimate if you were part-time. There are too many changes to keep up with how quickly things are changing and still give accurate estimates and good advice to your clients.
Well, I think it was you that told me a little while ago when we talked about that good faith estimate. If somebody made a mistake in selecting local lender or a lender in general, say 5 years ago, you could probably just abandon that lender, right? And then 3 days later get another loan approval with the person on down the street or whatever it is, whatever happened back then, right?
Yeah, because things happened a lot quicker back then. And truthfully, if you picked the wrong lender, they still probably would have been able to get the transaction closed because everybody qualified 4 years ago, you know? So you could have had a poor experience, and you might not want to do business with that person in the future, but the transaction might have still closed. It just might have been a poor experience. But anymore, if you make that wrong choice, it's going to potentially lead to not closing and, you know, nobody
wants that
result.
Yeah, and redisclosure or delays, right, because now you've got that new rule that says you got to redisclose if things change. So that's got to be a nightmare as far as if a mistake is made. So I applaud you again for staying on top of that. As long as we're on the subject, let's talk a little bit about trying to help a consumer here make a better decision. Talk to us about what's your opinion, whether, A, they should, you know, try to go this alone without a real estate agent, because I think that was probably more common 5 years ago than it is today. So give us your opinion on, A, should they go this alone, and if you want to get your answer to that first, go ahead.
No, I don't see how you can buy or sell a property without the help of a real estate agent, and especially to buy a property. You know, there's such a high percentage of homes that are either bank-owned homes and short sales, and you know, you're dealing with banks and negotiators and loss mitigators, and there's just so many hands involved, and it's so much more complicated than it used to be. And if you don't have a real estate agent, then your access to the multiple listing service is limited, and you don't have access to the most recently listed properties, and you don't know how to research what their value is and how to write a contract offer and how to negotiate. So Now, I don't see how anybody could go it alone, but especially as a buyer, I just can't see how anybody would have any success doing that right now.
And that being said, then, what do you see as either, what would you say is some of the mistakes that people make when they go out? If you're going to choose a real estate agent, I mean, you've been around the block enough and you're local to your market down there. What mistakes do you see people make when they go select a real estate agent?
Well, I think there's two big ones. I think one is that a lot of people choose their realtor by an ad in a magazine or a sign in the yard. And I think that if somebody asked me what would you choose your lender on, what criteria is most important, I'd say you need to work with a lender who's an expert. And I'd use that same criteria for a realtor. If you're looking to work with a realtor, I think you've got to find an expert. I think you've got to find the best and somebody who's going to be a negotiator who understands the market and who understands how to work their way through a transaction. That might hurt somebody's feelings if you don't use your cousin who's a part-time realtor on the other side of town. But in a financial transaction as big as purchasing a property, I think that it might upset someone if you don't use a friend or person you went to middle school with or someone in the neighborhood. But if that person isn't the expert that you feel like is going to do the best job for you, I think you're better off going elsewhere and finding that expert. I think the second mistake people make are, I think a lot of people don't realize that if you're loyal to one realtor, you're going to have much better success. And I think you'll have people driving around and looking at properties on their own and then having two or three realtors sending them listings. The problem with that is you have two or three realtors sending you things part-time because you haven't committed to one, so you're not getting their best efforts in many cases. And the criteria that you've used to find those realtors that you're shopping with, so to speak, it's probably not great criteria. It's probably a sign in the yard or a flyer you got in your mailbox or something like that. So I think if I'm looking for a realtor, I find the best person, get a referral, make sure they're an expert, and once I find them, I stick with them and I'm loyal, and they're my realtor.
It's so interesting you said that. You are a breath of fresh air because I did a survey. I actually did a program a few days ago, and we had 28 or 30 realtors in the room. And I just asked the question. I said, what do you see as the mistake that people make when they're out there with a real estate agent? They say, well, they don't understand agency, which I think was your point, is that the person who's got the ad in the paper or the sign in the ground, who are they really representing? They're representing the seller, right? They're not representing
right.
The buyer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so consequently, you're kind of playing to the hand of the seller, which is not really what you want to be able to do with that. So that was one of the ones that they talked about. They also mentioned the loyalty factor. They said if they were a consumer, you should interview the real estate agent because a lot of times there's a personality conflict. I mean, you've got to be able to like the person that you're dealing with. You're going to be in the car with them, looking at houses, going through things that you would be able to completely expose yourself and give you some tastes and. I've always told people you find what you like through what you don't like, but I think it's just a matter of get a pulse on what's going on, and that's great advice. And you're right on the money, Mike, I mean, as far as what's going on. And we've seen it. I mean, we have seen, and I know as much for you as it was for me early on, it's a nightmare to unravel some of the tangles that some of these things cause us. So let me just try to summarize for us a little bit. First of all, you would tell a consumer that, A, they should meet with their lender early in the process, right?
Yes.
Both parties, if at all possible, face-to-face,
yep.
Right? Bring documentation so that you can, I used to call those Swiss cheese approvals. I mean, what difference does it make if I got a loan approved if it says subject to you verifying my income? I mean, how do I know? And I'm going to take my house off the market for somebody like that, so great advice there. Obviously, the credit scores is constant. That hour that they're going to invest with somebody, whether that's you or somebody else in the marketplace, I mean, obviously, that you're one of the best down there. When you're looking at this and really understanding this, the FICO score piece, being able to save thousands of dollars, when to lock in, when not to lock in, which product to select, right? There's still a mix of products. Some people are still a little paranoid over adjustables, and sometimes it's good for an adjustable. It's a custom world, right?
Very custom world.
And I think in your real estate arena, it makes all the sense in the world to be able to do that. But it's just just an awesome way to be able to approach it. And I know, Mike, that it's got to be harder and more time-consuming Let me just clarify for the for a listener today. Do you charge for the? I mean, if you have somebody come in for an hour, I think is what your thought process was of how long it would take. Do you charge somebody for that? Is it does it cost me any money? Do I have to bring a checkbook with me since I haven't selected a property yet? Talk to us about that.
No, yeah, it's not like going to a CPA or an attorney where you're getting billed hourly. There's not a charge for the face-to-face consultation.
And obviously you spend some money and obviously your time, so and then you just compete in the arena with everybody else, right? I mean, so once they do find a property, I'm sure that you've got to be competitive in your interest rate. You've got to be, I mean, you can't be way out of the market, but you also got to be able to have enough money there to be able to make a living. So, you know, that's a good point that people need to be able to understand with that. So I think that the way you do it is so powerful to really be able to make sure people really start to understand where it is. And I can tell you that from my experience, people like you in the marketplace, referrals come fast and furious.
100% referral for about 6 years now.
Wow. Yeah, and I think that when you say referral, you're talking about either real estate agents or your past clients, or you're not old enough to be able to start getting generational jumps yet where you've done the parents and then you wind up doing the kids, but that will come with time. I applaud you for this, my friend. I think that the way you do business is probably the wave of the future. I think the consumer, from my perspective, is the consumer is they have a burning desire for what you have to be able to provide them. I really don't think for the single largest financial transaction of your life, you should do it over the Internet. Peter Lynch talked about that a long time ago that said large transactions will probably still be done face-to-face. Mike, if somebody wanted to get a hold of you, how would they go about that?
Well, you can either email me, which is my email address is msmalley, S-M-A-L-L-E-Y, at waterstonemortgage, and that's mortgage all spelled out, .com. Or probably better just to call the office. The office line's 407-644-0870.
Thank you so much for your time. I appreciate it. I know if I'm listening to this as a consumer nationwide in your market, whatever it is, I think it's going to be a breath of fresh air, and I think it's going to be a standard that you're going to be able to set and potentially change a lot of the way things are done in this industry. And for that, I applaud you for it. Thanks again.
Thanks, Tom. Thanks for having me.